The Lord reigns. Let the earth rejoice. Let the many coastlands be glad. Clouds and thick darkness are all around him. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne. Fire goes up before him and burns up all his adversaries all around. His lightnings light up the world. The earth sees and trembles. The mountains melt like wax before the Lord of all the earth. The heavens proclaim his righteousness, and all the peoples see his glory. All worshippers of images are put to shame, who make their boast in worthless idols. Worship him, all you gods. Zion hears and is glad, and the daughters of Judah rejoice because of your judgments, O Lord. For you, O Lord, are most high over all the earth. You are exalted far above all gods. O you who love the Lord, hate evil. He preserves the lives of his saints. He delivers them from the hand of the wicked. Light is sown for the righteous, and joy for the upright in heart. Rejoice in the Lord, O you righteous, and give thanks to his holy name, the word of the Lord.
Some of you remember when you use keyboard strokes to command a computer. Then we had mouse or mice to move the information and the images around. I remember when we got our first computer in 1990, it was that little 4-inch Mac. We got it because Celeste could get it with an educational discount. We upgraded it from 2 to 4 megabytes. Five years later, we'd have another computer and we'd be online and we had our AOL account. Now we live in a generation where people use touchscreens to move information around. And more the interaction is there on the screens, whether they are on a computer, a tablet, a smartphone. Notice I said smartphone, not cell phone. Do you realize in this last December, we passed a cultural and a commercial milestone? 51% of American adults now use smartphones, phones that are connected to the web, that have cameras, that can take videos. That is the majority culture. Now, there's nothing wrong with not having a smartphone, but we have to realize that things are changing around us even if we are not changing. Now, one of the things that's happened is that we have things like Twitter where you can have 140 characters and send a message. There is now this thing that, which is, you know, we've got the Twitter account, which is the little blue bird, and down on the bottom you have the symbol for Vine, which is to put up a 6-second video on Twitter. It's an application. 6 seconds is an important number. The average person blinks every 5 seconds. So you're either going to expand your attention because you're getting used to something different, or you'll have to refocus at least one time to make you come back to what you're watching. And what we will do is we will train ourselves for little bites of information, little bites of visual information, which we know can be the most deceptive, because when you have visual information, you realize that someone made a choice about what's going to be in the frame, whether it's up close or out far. It can never tell all the stories. Now, one of the things I recognize in a Christian church is that not everybody is into cyberculture. Not everybody understands it. Sometimes we feel like technology is becoming intrusive into our lives, that they are able, through, as in Seattle, when they were just testing drones in the police department, the people were so afraid of them. And I realize it's a good public debate that they shut down the experiment. They weren't even being used. They were just teaching the policemen how to fly them in a hangar. And so we have this cultural battle between privacy, which we value, and security, which we value. And I would submit to you that sometimes in our culture, in our society, in our hearts, privacy and security can become idols. They can become ultimate values, things that we have to have. An anthropologist at MIT wrote a book recently that is called, it's her third book in her analysis of cyberculture. It's called Alone Together. We are raising a generation of people who would rather be in front of their screens, interact through instant messages and things like that, because they can control the message, they can control when they see it, they can take as much time or as little time as they want. And what she is saying, as someone who has studied cyberculture for the last 20 years, is that we need to teach young people how to have intimate, interpersonal conversations. That is a skill that is being lost. Now, you've heard me tell the story of my conversation with my parents before I went to Europe the first time, and I was talking to them, and they told me that they felt good that they had learned to talk to each other in their marriage. That wasn't something that, coming out of their family background, the Depression, World War II, that they had really been fostered. We need to realize that we may be raising a generation of people who have a hard time with intimacy because of technology. They hide behind it. They get this false sense of intimacy that then can also be transferred into their relationship with God. Now, you know that for the last 15 or 17 years, I have used the internet to have my devotions, to keep my journal, to read the Bible, to read Oswald Chambers. That purposely I said, I want to understand what that does to someone. Can you keep a deep, personal, moment-by-moment relationship with God through a screen? I think you can, but it's hard work. Just like I think you can through a book, and it's hard work. We're going to talk about the hard work in a minute. Now, in this psalm, what I want you to hear is the good news is that the Lord reigns. He's in charge. He rules. That's what the beginning of this psalm is all about. This is a psalm that can we have the next slide? Sorry. This psalm, you know, for the last two psalms, I've been taking you back and I'm taking you forward. We've gone around. What you need to realize about this psalm, the reason I'm not doing that is because this psalm is a collection of phrases, verses, ideas from other psalms, and we're not going to go explore all the roots, because I want to emphasize the main thing, that the declaratory statement at the beginning of this: the Lord reigns, let the earth rejoice. Two very important ideas. God's in charge over everything. You see, one of the things that people want out of computers is control. When Harry Potter was out and people were wondering, what is the attraction of Harry Potter? Now, there's a lot of attraction for Harry Potter, because Harry Potter in the English world is another orphan story. English literature is full of orphan stories. We love them because we identify with them. But one of the things about the kind of witchcraft in Harry Potter was they were able to say something and get an outcome. They were able to control their environment through words. These were young people who were raising around computers, where if you do the computer program, you get an answer. You control. You see, what we as Christians need to realize is that God's in charge, not us. We're never going to be in charge. We have to make responsible decisions. We have responsibility, but God is the one who rules over all the earth. Some of those awesome weather pictures that we saw from outer space, to see the swirls and how big it is and say it, not us. You see, we have an appetite for control in a world that is built on the assumption that life is about chance and randomness in an impersonal universe. Think about that. If you're raised to believe in evolution, to believe that life is just matter and energy, that it's random, that it is by chance, and you look around at your relationships, you look around at your world, and you say, I got to figure out how to be in charge. I want to control something in my life. See, the good news, and I want us to understand as Christians that the good news is that the Lord reigns. That's what this psalm is all about, that he reigns. No matter what happens in your life, good or sadness, you're never going to have enough information to understand why that happened. See, this psalm is as much a confession of faith, a statement about what we think is true about a worldview as anything. But yet it is a worldview, it is a statement that is so against what we are taught in our culture and in our world. We build these massive, and I mean massive, acre-by-acre server farms trying to control life. We still have to dig out of 3 feet snowstorms. We still have to do with down power lines, babies being born at home, a child that dies of carbon monoxide poisoning while the father is trying to dig out his car. That's life, the good and the sad. You see, one of the things I think that we need to understand as Christians is that when we are asking someone to become a Christian, we are asking them to leave a world of images, to be live in a world of a text. And you see, what I want to tell you is that is not a modern issue. You know that I've been to Egypt twice. I've been to places that were older than Abraham. I think that when God was giving his revelation through Moses and beginning to have things written down, he waited till the technology of writing was at the place where it was away from the pictograms of in all the pictures of Egypt into what we think of as text, alphabets, words. Words that can be translated. How many people now with Vine and other things are going to have images, 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 and we say when you come to Jesus Christ, you also come to the Word. And we need to understand for some people how big of a shift that is. See, a lot of us are used to it. I had this Bible read to me by the time I was 4 years old. I've grown up with it. I'm used to it. I can't imagine life without it. But yet I knew after I graduated from high school and I went around with our intern at my church, that in 1967, the summer of 67 in Southern California, that there were many, many homes in my neighborhood around the church in 1967 that did not have a Bible in them. When I talked to Australian chaplains, they said they are into their fifth generation of biblical illiteracy. So when we say the Lord reigns, and that's good news, that it comes from a text, we need to realize how far people have to come. And see, I tell you this because I don't necessarily mean that everybody's going to run out and have a cyber friend or something like that, but you need to support people who are trying to reach like that and realize that when people walk through the door, some of them are going to come from the cyber culture. They're going to come because they've seen our website. Now, again, I've tried to organize the psalm and the sermon around kind of three simple imperatives. Rejoice, give thanks, and love. We rejoice because the Lord is in charge. We give thanks because the Lord is holy. And we love because the Lord is real. Let's look at rejoice. Now, this psalm has what I think of as bookend verses. You know, you've got an idea at the beginning, you've got an idea at the end, and both have to do with rejoice. Verse 1, the Lord reigns, let the earth rejoice, let many coastlands be glad. How does it end? Verse 12, rejoice in the Lord, you righteous, give thanks to his holy name. When we think about the command, the imperative to rejoice, that's meaning you have to choose it. You have to choose to rejoice. You have to say, I want to rejoice because of who God is. See, it's not your situation. It's not your place in life, your stage in life. It's not whether it's good or bad, but I want to rejoice in the Lord. I want to find my joy in the Lord in spite of the sadness, disappointment, all the things that can be happening to me. I choose to rejoice. It is a choice. And so we rejoice because he's in charge. I think that's one of the things that as you get older, you realize more and more that though, you know, I took the title, or part of the title for the sermon from a 1964 Bob Dylan song that was both a title cut and the album title, The Times They Are A-Changin', which was true, but also expressed the arrogance of my generation that somehow we were different than any other generation, that there hadn't been change before us and there wouldn't be change after us. So something can be both true and arrogant. But we realize that the times are changing now. Because more and more people are willing to check that none box in terms of religious faith. And so when we say that I'm going to rejoice, I'm going to find my joy in the fact that God is sovereign over all creation. And so I want to ask you, do you choose joy in the Lord? Is that a conscious choice for you? Is that something for you as you are aware? Or do you just let life wash over you and just feel like you have no control over your emotions, no control over your response to your life, that you can't choose joy? That you can't choose joy in the Creator who is also the Redeemer? In the New Testament, Paul reminds us that joy is part of the fruit of the Spirit. That if you have the Spirit, you can choose fruit, the fruit of joy. But when you see the command, the imperative to rejoice, it's asking you to make a choice. It's asking you to make a conscious choice. It's asking you to think about your relationship to God. We've talked about worship and understanding being in the very presence of God. Is that something that gives you joy? Or is that something you just allow to be some kind of memory in the background and you're focused so much on the world around you, on the situation around you, on the whatever is there? But see, we're also told to give thanks. See, that's one of the things I think about in choosing these three imperatives: to rejoice, to give thanks, to love. Because the application that I have for you and your life from these texts comes right out of it, and it's very simple, and sometimes when things are simple, it's easy to overlook. Now, giving thanks is perhaps easier to articulate than rejoicing. Because usually we think about giving thanks for something in particular. It has a focus. Whereas joy is just something that builds up as an emotion within us. When you look at the dictionary, when you look at the description of what it means to rejoice, it means to be full of joy. It is its own self-definition. But we think about giving thanks, and the Psalms are filled again and again with telling us to give thanks, commanding us to give thanks. But yet, when we sit in front of our screens tell us that we should want something more, something better, something newer, because we are being trained to be a consumer, to be a customer, which ultimately means I am being trained to be dissatisfied with life. Because there's always something more that you need. That's what the whole consumer-customer training is all about. So for many people, dissatisfaction with life, with other people, is the default of their world. They're always dissatisfied. Something can always be better. It is that dissatisfaction that sometimes turns into distrust of any kind of relationship because you know that you are going to be disappointed. Because if you start out dissatisfied, you're going to end up often being disappointed and living out that self-prophecy that you have created. And we need to realize that sometimes that is the operating system, that is our way of thinking, that is the default, or however you want to describe it, in our lives often. That sometimes it's so much there in the background that we don't realize that I am dissatisfied because that's the way I have been trained. And so again, we need to realize that when God tells us to give thanks, it's going against our culture and the way our world looks at things to give thanks. And I love this. In verse 12, give thanks to his holy name. We need to reclaim the holiness of God. The sense that we are in his presence, that we are in the presence of a holy God. See, he is holy first because he is totally separate from his creation, that he is the only thing that is not created, that is eternal, that is so against what our world teaches that matter and energy are eternal. We say God the Creator is eternal. And that's why we can give thanks that he is holy. He is holy in a moral and righteous way, that he has never sinned. But yet we are to give thanks. One of the most powerful stories about giving thanks in difficult situations was given to me by a Ugandan pastor back in the days, and this is before a lot of you, but back in the days when Idi Amin was bringing terror onto his own country. This pastor saw a mother of three children. They had not eaten in several days. And they came across a dried banana peel. There were four parts to the peel. The kids grabbed for it, but the mother put her hand and says, no, we need to give thanks. She could see in that dried banana peel God's presence in their lives, God's provision for them. Most of us have no idea, unless we have been there and seen it, what poverty is. And so often we find strong living faith among the poor. People who are able to give thanks for things we completely overlook. But yet he is holy and we should give thanks because of that. That there is a standard, that there is a right way of doing things, that there is a way that God has revealed that we are to live in his creation. That we are to be holy. We don't use the word that much anymore, but I remember when we used to talk about holy matrimony. That adjective, that description of a marriage relationship was something that we saw because it was something that God brought Adam and Eve together. It was something holy because God was there, because we believe that what God joined together, that no man separate. That has been lost. When more children are born without their fathers in the home. But yet, we should give thanks because even though our culture has changed, God has not changed. He is holy. And so we should rejoice and we should give thanks that the Creator is there. That there is a holy and pure way of life. A way that God has created for us because He is the Creator, because He is reign. But we need to choose to give thanks. On Facebook, every so often, I'll see these different groups of people that are going through 30 days of giving thanks, or people who share with their friends a nightly email, I'm thankful today for, because they choose to find something to give thanks for. Again, you have to choose to give thanks, to make it a part of your life. You live in a world that wants you to be dissatisfied, and God says, give thanks. It's a choice. Now, rejoice, give thanks, and love. Yesterday and today, in reading Oswald Chambers, I ended up with what amounts to almost two bookends for this part of the sermon. Oswald Chambers was a British evangelist, Bible college trainer and beginner, and he founded a Bible college. He died in Egypt during World War I as a chaplain from cerebral meningitis. Yesterday, he asked a question about exhaustion. And this is someone writing around World War II. Someone whose wife took copious notes. She was a court stenographer before she married her husband, so then she copied everything. And she was the one who actually put together his books from his writings after he died. That's the way she made ends meet. Have you ever delivered yourself over to exhaustion because of the way you've been serving God? If so, then renew and rekindle your desires and your affections. Examine your reasons for service. Is your source based on your own understanding, or is it grounded on the redemption of Jesus Christ? Continually look back on the foundation of your love and affection and remember where the source of your power is. So many of us in the Protestant world have grown up rightly being taught that we need to have faith and we need to repent. Those are God's graces that should shape our love for Him. Remember what God said through Moses to the God's people? Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. John reminds us in 1 John 4 that God loved us first and sent His Son as an atoning sacrifice. Paul said that God shows His love for us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Love is a word that we do not use that often in Protestant circles to talk about our relationship with God, but this passage and others, from the beginning of Scripture to the end of Scripture, remind us that we are to love God, that we are to have that passionate affection for Him, that our affections often drive our expectations, that our affections drive our passions and the use of our time. Notice how he describes the reader. Oh, you who love the Lord, hate evil. That's why I say love the Lord, because He's real. This psalm, like other psalms, raises the issues of idolatry with just a few words. All worshippers of images are put to shame who make their boast in worthless idols. In this morning's Oswald Chambers reading, he says, referring to the people of Isaiah's time, but we refer to anybody's time. That our minds have been blinded in the ability to see God because we've been looking too often at idols. The real test of spiritual focus is being able to bring your mind and thoughts under control. Is your mind focused on the face of an idol? Is the idol yourself? Is it your work? Is it the idea of what a servant should be, or maybe the experience of salvation or sanctification? If so, then your ability to see God is blinded. You see, we need to love Him. We need to love Him because if we love Him, that's where our affection and our attention is going to be. So you put your attention on what you love, what you stare at, what you look at, what you think of. See, that's one of the things that happened technologically when we went from movies to screens. We went from being in the dark half the time, even though we didn't realize it, so we were refocusing, whereas screens teach you to stare because the light is constant. It draws you in. But you need to choose, because you love Him, who you are going to stare at. Are you going to focus on God? Are you going to say, I love the Lord because He's real? You see, we live in a world that wants you to focus on idols or other things because they don't believe that God is real. So we need to rejoice, give thanks, and love. And now for some final thoughts. Because this is my last sermon, I wanted to give you some choices. Some of these come out of the sermon, some of these come out of other things that I've said to you. But we are always to love our holy Lord who reigns over all of creation. Loving a holy God who is the Creator is one of the most foundational parts of our faith. Remember what the Apostle Creed, how it begins. I believe in God the Father, Creator of heaven. You know, He's the Creator. But then about the church. Remember that you are the church bought with the blood of Christ. You are not your own. And coming from today, I tell you to rejoice and to give thanks. Those are choices we are to make every day. We are not to be dissatisfied. We are to be thankful people. We are to rejoice because of who God is. And then to take time with the Lord to have that devotional life, both as individuals, as families, and to understand that He is with us moment by moment. Not to get distracted by the world, but to get focused on that God is with us. And then to make room for a stranger. As Dave prayed, we are to be a missionary church. I want you to fight the defaults of life, a life of dissatisfaction, to rejoice, give thanks, and love. But this week, it's Valentine's week, so you're going to hear a lot about love that's going to be sold to you, or that you can buy. And I think there's nothing wrong with showing special people love. But love takes both thoughts and time. Remember, you were loved first by Jesus Christ. That's what we're going to celebrate. That He came and died on the cross because He loved us. We have been loved first, therefore we should love. Let us now prepare our hearts to come to celebrate the Lord's Supper.